you know, at the end of our conversations in the immediate aftermath of this decision, I, you know, used some foul language to say that basically Canada's really screwed up right now. Hello and welcome to the High Level Showdown, episode 138. We are proud members of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. Hello everyone, my name is Michael, of course joined by Sharon and Elliot on this 138th episode. And, you know, this is, week to week, we look for potential stories to discuss. And sometimes we have to search, and sometimes they're delivered to us on a platter.
Oh, yeah. And so, I think last week, we were like, oh, we got all our topics for
next
week.
Right. Yeah. So, of course, the big ongoing topic that we've talked about on this show many times is the Trans Mountain Pipeline, and now the latest developments to come out last week, actually. So we recorded, you know, on Tuesday, and then the day after, 2 days after, this bombshell comes.
Yeah, way to go, courts. Why weren't you taking our show into consideration when you're making these decisions?
Honestly.
Selfish, really, honestly.
So what happened, Michael?
Well, so the Federal Court of Appeal announced that the pipeline that the Canadian government now owns, that we all own as taxpayers.
We are all pipeline owners.
That's right. The Trans Mountain Pipeline, which had, the construction had started, the Federal Court of Appeal says construction must halt because the federal government failed in its consultation with Aboriginal people, and the environmental assessment was rushed and not thorough. Therefore, this pipeline is being built under circumstances that are not acceptable. So they ordered a halt to the project.
And everyone was shook.
There was lots of controversy. Before we get into it, I want to make an apology because we have talked about this quite a bit. And one of the interesting episodes was a one-on-one discussion between our good friend from BC, Jordan, and myself, where we really laid into each other about this project, him being a BCer, me being an Albertan. And some of it was hyperbolic. But one of the points that I made in that conversation was that the Trudeau government, after having taken power, had gone through another consultation process with Indigenous peoples. And my feeling was that because of that, they had gotten to the point where they had, you know, reached whatever level they needed to reach in order to say, yes, we did consult, and therefore we're going to move forward with this project. What this court decision said last week is that that was not the case. So I was actually incorrect about that. I actually thought that the consultation had been much more extensive than what was actually outlined. So I want to start off this show with an apology to Jordan and our listeners for misunderstanding the information.
A rare retraction.
Yeah, rare retraction from Elliot.
And I think it's an important point. I mean, if you know, consultation too often is seen as, I am doing what you want. I'm going to hear what you have to say and I'm doing what you want. That's not the purpose of consultation. In fact, it's often in those consultations, the nitty-gritty details around the minuscule impacts of a project are heard and then adjusted to. Very rarely is a consultation process going to lead to an end of a the end of a project, particularly one of this size and with this kind of economic impact on a country. But if that process is not done thoroughly and effectively enough, then I think the courts are well justified to make this decision, as unhappy as it makes many Albertans here.
Yeah, so let's talk about the reaction to this, particularly from, you know, the Albertan perspective.
Well, before we go into the reactions, the timing of it was funny because less than half an hour later, 99.9% of the Kinder Morgan board approved the sale of the pipeline. Yeah. So it was kind of funny. It was a whole thing where, they're like probably thrilled to get that off their hands. And of course, we talked about how, I mean, we all got played with their whole deadline and everything that. So.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, we could get in. History will forever debate the impact and the whether Justin Trudeau and the Liberals should have bought the pipeline.
For
I don't think that we'll ever come to a conclusion one way or another whether it was the right thing to do. Environmentalists certainly have their opinion. pro-business, pro-oil.
Have theirs.
Economically minded individuals have theirs, let's just say. But it is interesting, and it was sort of a shot in the gut after what was, you know, a pretty brutal blow to the face, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, especially because the physical construction had started, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, sort of. I think that they were surveying land.
Sure. But I mean,
Rachel Notley had done that mission accomplished, kind of had her mission accomplished with the spades in the ground.
And her hard hat on.
And the heart, and so he was there, and it was this whole
thing. Speaking of Rachel Notley, reactions.
Yes, so obviously the Albertans weren't happy. Premier Notley was not happy, and, had a very, I guess what we call it, hostile press conference, to the point, a direct...
guns blazing, pretty
directed
much.
At Ottawa, you know, verbatim. Ottawa broke it. Ottawa needs to fix it. And, you know, she's telling Justin Trudeau what he needs to do. He needs to recall Parliament. What she suggests to him, recall Parliament and immediately appeal this ruling to the Supreme Court of Canada. And, of course, until then, Alberta is going to pull out of the federal climate plan, and because, of course, as she says, it is not worth the paper it's written on without Alberta's signature. So, tough talk from the premier, but, you know, certainly I think a representation of the feeling of many Albertans.
Sharon, pulling out of the national climate deal, what impact does that have?
Well, it was interesting because the next morning, Rachel Notley called into CBC Edmonton AM and was talking about this. And forgive me because I forgot the world news reporter who was taking over from Mark Conley that day. But she asked her, well, this climate action plan, is that just like a symbolic move? And Rachel Notley kind of took a few minutes, was like, no, I mean, it does mean something. And Elliot, you had the comment in our group chat, like, she should have repealed the carbon tax.
I went all in on that.
Because really the national climate plan...
Well, it is seen by many as symbolic, right?
It is symbolic.
Well, it does set targets, but they're long, you know, they're distant targets.
Yes, exactly. It's like 2020, whatever.
And there's expectations around, yeah.
Exactly. So pulling out of it immediately really doesn't have, it doesn't really have that much weight at this time. I think there's not a lot of impact that people feel because of this. Ottawa isn't impacted immediately from this. I mean, it's really shitty for Justin Trudeau because this is his whole thing. But I think in terms of what it actually means for people day to day, it's kind of just like a whatever move. I agree with Elliot. It probably would have been a lot more effective if she said, I'm getting rid of the carbon tax, mostly for the Albertan people who want this pipeline to be built. They'll be like, wow, she's really
serious
about this.
But then wouldn't it have been seen, as Elliot also mentioned, that, turning against her values to kill
the
carbon tax?
Well, she's already gone down that road.
Part of it is that...
She's so far gone.
Part of the justification for the carbon tax, the royalty review that left royalty rates relatively the same, very pro-business government. I think the UCP would not say this, but I think lots of people would say that Rachel Notley, for an NDP premier, has been very pro-business and pro-industry. This pipeline and her fighting for it, chief among it. I do think it signals, though, that... by repealing the carbon tax, which is obviously the conversation that was in the immediate aftermath of that, it does undermine her credibility in some ways, in the sense that the expectation was that we do these things, then we get the social license to create this project, and it will happen. Now, that house of cards has somewhat fallen apart because of this judicial ruling and this decision. I think it was she did say that she was going to freeze the carbon tax, so it won't be going up to meet those rates I think the national strategy calls for. I mean, I think it would have been really interesting for Rachel Notley to have declared at that moment, I'm canceling the carbon tax and I am going to be joining the lawsuit with Premier Doug Ford and Saskatchewan against the federal government until this project moves forward, because we've shown that, you know, the federal government is not reasonable and does not take this project seriously, or something along those lines, right? I think it would have been interesting to see that. Hindsight leaves me thinking, well, does that undermine her credibility in terms of creating social license to create projects? And so you have to weigh things back and forth on that. And I'm sure in that morning, in the immediate aftermath of the ruling, there were probably some pretty fiery debates about what their next step should be.
And with the election so close, it's really pushed Notley's government to really walk a fine line. Many people on the left would say she's fallen on the other side of the line. She's gone too far. She's abandoned all her values and morals and principles around environmental change and things like that. But you really see that Rachel Notley is doing whatever it takes and going, pushing as far as she can within reason to win that election.
Yeah. Well, she wants to be obviously that premier that got the pipeline done.
Yes.
Right? And so we thought it was going to be done. As we said, there was that ceremony. She had the hard hat on, right?
Without that pipeline, so, she's definitely
exactly.
done.
And
we've been saying that since this podcast started. Yeah.
And the fact is that, as you mentioned, Sharon, the timeline is running out. The election's coming up.
It is.
Right? We have 10 months.
That's accelerated everything that she's done.
So, yeah.
Michael,
clock is ticking.
What do you think in terms of strategy? What does the future look like? Is there, like, my immediate thought in the immediate aftermath of this decision, and even in the evening after Rachel Notley's speech, that you did say was fiery, I sort of got this feeling, well, if she wasn't done before, she certainly is now.
Yeah.
Is that your perception?
I do think that if it doesn't get completed, it will be, I mean, it's a failure on obviously large, even though she said Alberta did nothing wrong. This is all Ottawa's fault. It's their mess to clean up. But it will fall on her if it's not done. I think this is a big deal breaker for the election.
Sure.
I mean, I'm not one of many. Obviously, we know the anger towards the NDP on many things. But this is certainly one of the bigger ones, I would say.
Yeah, I agree with Michael. I don't know if some Albertans' distaste for Justin Trudeau and blaming Ottawa will be enough to be able to help Rachel Notley save face and win in the next election. But again, last week we were just talking about how there's no way she's probably going to win this election anyway,
yeah,
right?
So it's like, it's one of many things against her, right? It doesn't help.
Exactly.
Although if it did happen, it might help her. But if not happening, it certainly doesn't help her. Yeah,
she's sort of lost that opportunity. Well, I mean, you saw her try and capitalize on what's a something many Alberta premiers have done, which is, capture the sentiments of Albertans about the federal government and particularly Liberal Prime Minister's name, Trudeau. and you did see that in some of her speech. She also evoked and alluded to the president in the South. To the south of us in the United States, and called it a victory for Donald Trump. I think there was she alluded to a victory for states that produce oil and move oil across the country that maybe do not have the stupendous human rights records that Canada does. Namely Iran or Saudi Arabia. So I think there was a mention there. She did basically use all the demons in her toolbox to try and save face on this. But I think I am with you. It will be difficult. One, the timelines don't seem to add up so that they are going to be, that this really can be overturned in time for the next election.
Yeah.
Which is basically what this comes down to, is time.
Yeah.
You could tell that this was not in the cards for anyone involved, whether it be the prime minister, the premier, or anyone across the country. This pipeline project had won, I think, 12 or maybe it was 17 court cases ahead of this one. And this is the first one to actually have lost. And obviously, it just takes one to shut down a project.
Yeah,
for sure.
But go ahead, Cher.
Well, I was saying we can't have this conversation about the election and what it means for Rachel Notley without talking about some of Jason Kenney's comments following this ruling. And, we can probably guess what Kenny said, although it is pretty ludicrous. So he started talking about separatism and equalization payments and how, if this doesn't do it,
speaking
I don't know.
Speaking of all the demons in the demon
tool. Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. He said, I'm sure lots of Albertans are toying with the idea with separatism right now. And he said, I'm a nationalist. But I don't support separating from the country, but I can still see how this is frustrating. Really weird rhetoric. He talked about if this pipeline doesn't get built and he's elected premier, he's gonna consider a referendum to rethink equalization payments and use that as a bargaining chip against Ottawa.
He's going to break the glass you know, he's going to take the mace itself to the and hammer in the spikes that are necessary. Jason Kenney's going to put the pipeline on his back.
Yeah. He's going to assert fairness for Alberta.
I mean, I think that's interesting because the notion, you know, the truth is whether it was a Jason Kenney premier, a Rachel Notley premier or anyone in between, the result would have been the same, you'd think, in this process. You would have thought, though, there was nothing that Alberta could have done.
And that's what Rachel Notley said. And we didn't do
anything. But it will never be interpreted as such. Yes. Can I just stop for a moment and just go on a little rant? And it's really rooted in my subtle frustration with the current political climate basically everywhere, but particularly in Canada right now and particularly in Alberta. The sense I got from the right in this country, whether it be the federal conservatives or the UCP here, the smugness and the seeming almost joy that they took in this judicial decision. Mm. Although they did get their key messages out, it was almost as though, you know, if you're going to be the party that is for the oil worker, that is for pro-business, is for getting people back to their jobs, the inherent smugness that followed this decision from the right, whether it be UCP caucus members or potential MLAs, Jason Kenney himself, or the federal conservatives, Andrew Scheer, and the number of MPs, Michelle Rempel, for example, the sheer smugness and joy that they took in the failure of this project up to this point. You know, 200 people lost their jobs on the spot.
Yes.
As was reported as soon as this judicial ruling came through. If this pipeline doesn't get built, that's 5,000 Albertans potentially, and more so in BC, who aren't going to be working, who thought they had a job and an opportunity. And if you're going to be the party and the group of individuals that stand up for that group of people, smiling at the failure of your opponents just because you're going to score a couple political points is cheap. And really undermines your credibility, in my mind, when you make those kind of statements that you care about Alberta workers or you care about the pipeline industry and pipe layers and the subsequent industries that are associated with it. I'm not saying it was overt. I think some people did take liberties. I'm not going to name names, but you can't
name them.
No, there was too much inherent smugness associated with this decision, and the impact that this is going to have on thousands of people's lives if this project doesn't go through, regardless of what side you're on. I don't think it's right to you know, treat this issue in that way, whether it's a political win for you or not, whether you're scoring points or not, you're still getting those points. But don't give me this smugness and then turn around and say you're for the Albertan worker. I think that it's I think it's inappropriate. I think it's unbecoming of leaders or potential leaders in this province and in this country. And you really have to reassess yourself if you're making light of the fact that 5,000 people potentially aren't going to be getting jobs.
Well said, Elliot.
Yes, I was going to say the same. That's very, very, very good. One thing that struck me, just in general, though, is as much as there is obstinate opposition to this project, there is also the obstinance from at least the Prime Minister. You know, he keeps saying, this is happening. This, I don't know how it's going to happen. Obviously, this is a big hurdle in the way, but still very adamant. This is going to happen. And of course, today, September 5th, the Prime Minister is in Edmonton and again reiterates to the media, this is happening. We have a few options. We don't know exactly how we're going to make it happen. One of them is, of course, an appeal to the Supreme Court, which Rachel Notley suggested. He also, you know, hinted at possibly just legislating that the pipeline continue to go forward. But again, the message of this is happening. I mean, do you think it's really realistic for proponents or the Prime Minister to continue to say this has happened? Is that even certain? Nothing has been certain at all through this whole pipeline discussion, and yet they are still going with the message of it's happening.
Well,
what
else are they going to say? Well, oh, guys,
yeah, you're right.
We fucked up. We're not sure what's going to happen.
I mean, I guess. I mean, I don't think the project. One thing I will say is this: is that the fact that, you know, everyone's saying the project is dead, the pipeline is over, it's all finished.
There's been many on the left that have been able to say that. The government is not saying
that. That's not true. There's a consultation process that they have to go through. They have to extend that consultation process. Whether that will certainly, almost certainly push the project through the next provincial election in Alberta. And so that will have great impact on Rachel Notley. That does not necessarily have the same impact on Justin Trudeau, who has longer before his next upcoming election.
Well, a few months.
And he talked about legislation.
In fairness, only a few months.
Yeah, a few months more. A lot more than that. About a year.
No.
9 months.
Well, the provincial election is in May.
And then the federal election would be in October or November, potentially.
Okay, but in the same year.
Yes, about a few more months. But, okay. You know, when you're talking about a consultation period,
yes, certainly,
when you're talking about an environmental assessment, yeah. You're talking about some strong legislation, yeah. There's a lot more tools in their toolbox. I don't think this project is dead by any means. In fact, I do believe the pipeline is going to get twinned and it will get built.
Boo!
Just not in time for... Rachel Notley.
No, for her sake.
For her sake. For
and
her,
maybe not even enough time for Trudeau.
I don't know.
So,
if you're dependent on that project and you can pull the levers of government, particularly around owners, you own the project, you have legislation that you can use as part of federalism and the powers of the federal government, you can push things through quicker.
Yeah.
And what if, worst case scenario... this goes to the Supreme Court and, you know, they also quash it.
But they just said that they need to increase the consultation process.
Yes,
you can readdress that way. Part of the issue around the waterways argument and what the courts took issue with was that it wasn't that the assessment and the impact on orca whales wasn't good enough. It just wasn't done at all because the Canadian Environmental Protection Agency, which is not the name of it, that's the United States name of it, National Energy Board, didn't feel as though waterways were part of its purview.
Yeah.
Well, and that's
which also, I mean, a lot of it also goes back to Harper and a lot of the things they did to,
fast track processes.
And
fast track processes,
yeah, exactly.
Which, undermines the credibility
of the project.
And that's
something that Rachel Notley did say in her CBC Edmonton interview, is that Harper made a lot of things happen that shouldn't have, sped up the process, took a lot of cuts, and so she wants the federal government to relook at that.
We've gone long on this topic, but I think it's an important one, given that we're based in Alberta. You know, at the end of our conversations in the immediate aftermath of this decision, I, used some foul language to say that basically Canada's really screwed up right now. And there are major divisions in this country that are starting to form. And whether it be, questions around federalism and the fight that's gone on between BC and Alberta, whether you see it at a political level and ideologies... are we, and I was, I took a very somber stance on that. Is that justified or am I overreacting?
I think it's fair to say that there are divisions that are clearly coming up and they're becoming very acute. I would agree with that, Elliot. Sharon's thinking.
I don't think you're being overdramatic. I think,
but it's a general cultural, political culture.
Yeah, it's
thing.
A general, and we've been talking about it on the show for a while now. This political culture that, on the surface level, Canada has been shielded from, I would say. But you have Bernier, and you have a lot of things that are cropping up in the immediate, and that's made it in the forefront that we're in trouble a little bit.
I mean, maybe I have too many friends hanging off bridges, blocking oil tankers, or people that I know anyway. And so it just feels as though this issue is so polarized. But there's no common ground. It seems like there was a time when you could institute a carbon tax and you could be mindful about capping the oil sands by 2100 and you could aim to meet emissions targets and... then you could also build a pipeline, and that was sort of...
it wasn't either or.
It wasn't either or, and it just doesn't seem like there's any compromise anymore. It's one or the other. There's nothing. It doesn't seem to be anything in between, and I wonder if, that seems to be something that we talk about a lot in another segment of this show, but I wonder if that's starting to creep into Canada, and it worries me a bit about our political culture in general, if the only way that anything happens is if it's a clear 100% win. when some of the best policies and some of the things we're best known for were compromises between the right and the left in this country. And, you know, every country for that matter.
Yeah.
That's time will tell. The High Level Showdown is a proud member of the Alberta Podcast Network, and the Alberta Podcast Network is powered by ATB. ATB is a big believer in acceptance everywhere, and this summer they've spent their time at the Pride Festivals, which they're proud sponsors of all across Alberta. This past weekend, they were seen in Calgary, because ATB believes that acceptance everywhere starts with acceptance here. They have representation of LGBTQ plus people in their team members, their allies, and they try through engagement, outreach, and education to build a more diverse and inclusive workplace, not only within their walls, but all across Alberta. ATB, proud sponsors of the Alberta Podcast Network. So last week was a pretty shitty week for Justin Trudeau, hey?
Yeah.
Not just this pipeline. But last weekend, of course, spilling into this week and will continue to be talked about is NAFTA.
We're getting a lot of life out of this.
Yeah, we really are. Trade wars left, right, and center. So... The Trudeau government has been having a hard time with our friendly Cheeto down south getting this NAFTA deal signed. Of course, the U.S. and Mexico have been having some bilateral agreements happening and bilateral talks. And there's a big push to be able to get a NAFTA deal signed before the Mexican presidential elections. And Justin Trudeau and his people cannot get it done. And there's lots of struggles going on for a variety of reasons. So why don't we break down some of these reasons for our listeners and try to touch on a little bit of the reasons why this is happening and maybe predict what's going to happen in the future.
Yeah, I think first off, what we should say is that this is a very complex...
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, very...
We are not trade experts.
Exactly. This is a very intricate, you know, discussion. And I can actually... I feel sympathy for the negotiators in terms of... I'm sure it's a headache.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's just... It is just a mountain of just... It must be so daunting to have these kind of high-level talks. And there's many
particularly things, when they're not in good faith, I will add.
That's right. Absolutely. But, you know, some of the key sticking points... that really, you know, have escalated, especially between Canada and the United States. Well, you know, the president has targeted our dairy farmers from almost the very beginning, hasn't he? You remember that, Elliot? We even did an episode, you know, early on in the presidency where he just lashed out how unfair Canada had been to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, supply management is something, a term that's been thrown around. It's actually becoming a political buzzword as Bernier splits off from the conservatives. Yeah. And one of the chief issues is his disagreement with supply management, which is basically states that the price of dairy and a number of other products, particularly cheese, but also eggs, milk, obviously, are controlled at a federal level to protect Canadian dairy farmers and have been for a long time. Obviously, this type of policy goes against the, spirit of a free trade agreement, but it's something that I think, you know, as we talk more and more, and might be worth getting into a little bit, is the dairy lobby in Canada, and how much of an impact it does have on Canadian politics, that industry does have. But it has created a large sticking point in these conversations, one that Trump continues to circle back to in these negotiations, and one that the Canadian government is quite keen to maintain in these negotiations. I think that was the one sticking point. But there's more to this.
Yes.
And just to carry on a little bit about supply management, so... our government right now, the current government, isn't the only one who's had to deal with this sticky situation of supply management. I think ever since it was kind of enacted in Canada, it has been a struggle for governments over the years to maintain this caveat in a lot of the relationships that they hold. And there has been small concessions made, like for the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Canada agreed to open a 3.25% in the domestic dairy imports. I know with the European Union, there was a few concessions made with trade around like mm-hmm. cheese and milk. And so they have tweaked those sorts of things a little bit before. And actually today, I think Trudeau mentioned that he is still committed to keeping supply management a thing, but is willing to look at ways to make this a little bit more agreeable. So I don't know if things shifted in the past day in mm-hmm. negotiations, and I don't know what this will mean for Canadian dairy farmers, but it seems like this might be, based on some of the things Trudeau said today, might be something they're willing to tweak.
Yeah, well, you know, every time Chrystia Freeland, the Minister of Foreign Affairs, came out of the meetings and at the media scrum, she kept repeating every time, it was a very warm discussion.
Yeah.
You know, it was all very
progress
good.
Progress is being made.
Yeah. So, I mean, we're assuming, obviously, she says so. We are assuming there is compromise happening there. But, mm-hmm. you know, we're dealing also with an American administration that doesn't understand that word.
Yes.
Or which, much of anything else,
for
frankly,
sure.
But.
Which I think leads us to the second thing, which is Chapter 19. And this is something that Trudeau has said, this is a non-negotiable, which from the beginning has been maybe the top thing that Trudeau has talked about.
Yeah. So what is Chapter 19, Sharon?
Chapter 19 is a really complicated part of it that talks about how you resolve disputes when things happen. So right now, if there's a dispute around trade, that goes through an independent kind of board or process with representatives from the different countries. This is supposed to be a neutral kind of process that doesn't tip the scale in any way for each country. If Trump has wanted to weaken Chapter 19, and so people have talked about the possibility of if we got rid of Chapter 19 or weakened it, you could see some trade disputes going through the American court system, which of course doesn't make it a very non-biased sort of process because you have American judges, American processes ruling on these trade disputes. So Chapter 19 is a really big caveat that Justin Trudeau said. Actually, he said, especially in the age of Trump and with Trump president, this is something we need more than ever because he's volatile. You don't know what's going to happen next.
Yeah.
So the Trudeau administration anticipates there might be even more disputes that come up with trade that they will need Chapter 19 to be able to keep NAFTA intact.
And I mean, that comes down to what's the point of having a deal if you can't enforce it, right?
Exactly.
And that's, and I mean, I think that, you know, it seems we're obviously simplifying this to the most that
sure.
we can, one for our audience and two for ourselves.
Yeah.
But ultimately what this comes down to is just that. When you have an issue, what means do you have to deal with it? If there is no means to deal with it, then you don't have a free trade agreement. Country A or Country B or Country C can do whatever they want to another country and not face repercussions or any sort of sanctions around that. And so, yeah, for me, it just is a no-brainer. But I could see why a U.S. government acting in bad faith with a bad faith actor at the head of its government would want a weakened dispute resolution process, because Trump's number one thing to do when he is pissed off at a country is to increase tariffs.
Yeah.
And tariffs are inherently against the spirit of a NAFTA free trade agreement, mm-hmm. a NAFTA mm-hmm. agreement.
Yeah. Well, one that he's called from the very beginning, one of the worst in the history of ever, the world and the United States, one of the most one-sided and, you know, rip-off agreements that the United States has ever signed.
Yeah.
Can you guys explain this last and third sticking point to me, because I have no idea what it means?
This is the cultural appropriation one, correct?
Yes.
Cultural exemption.
Cultural appropriation. Okay. Sorry.
Well, I mean,
the U.S. president cannot wear a Canadian flag.
Yes. So my understanding of this, and any listeners that have a different, you know, take on this, please correct us, because again, like Michael said, we are not experts. But
Trudeau, we are trying to simplify things
exactly.
for our listener and then bring you hard-hitting opinion on.
Yes, exactly. So the exemption on cultural industries is something that was part of the original NAFTA agreement, and it basically says that Canadians want to protect Canadian content. And so this can be as simple as when you go to a movie theater, you might pay more for American films and you might pay less for Canadian films. Or if you want to purchase a Canadian artist, that might be cost less and there might be higher prices for American artists, a picture or, you know, whatever it may be. And it also means that, in the example that Trudeau said today, was in a big American media company can't come up and say, hey, CTV, I'm going to buy you out for... Bell Media, I'm going to buy you out for, you know, a huge chunk of money, because, of course, that would mean that Canadian content is not pushed and thriving and, you know, something that people can easily access in Canada. So this is a big thing that... Trudeau said is we're not going to budge on this.
So this is essentially like the expectation that Canadian radio stations, if you're a Canadian radio station, like 70% or 69% of your content has to be Canadian content.
Exactly.
Not only that, this is it stems from a historical precedent. There was Prime Minister Pearson called the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism. And the reports, you know, found at the time, this is in the 1960s, that Canada was in a deep cultural crisis and was in danger of being really assimilated by the influence of American culture. And that Royal Commission recommended several steps be taken to affirm Canadian content, Canadian identity. Of course, certain number of things we see on TV or what we hear on the radio, certain number of items that have to be produced in Canada. So this is an extension of that. And I also think, you know, for those who are ignorant of North American life, you know, everybody knows about the United States, but they may not know about Canada. And what is one of the cliche questions that you ask a Canadian? Oh, what's unique about you? We're not American, you know, but what does that mean? So I think it's very important that differentiation is made.
I mean, particularly for any country. Well, when you're a country of, you know, whatever we are, 38 million people compared to a country of
350 million,
and the impacts, like, we see the impacts of American media and American culture on our lives.
Pervasive everywhere.
Even as is. And I think we see it the most in Alberta. And in fact, it's funny you mentioned that Royal Commission, because there's a previous Royal Commission on broadcasting that dates back to the early 1900s that led to the creation of the CBC that came after an alarming number of Southern Albertans were becoming Americanized to American culture because American radio was being able to be captured in southern parts of the country and the impact that it was having on Canadian culture. So I do now fully understand it. Thank you very much for the two of you. So Sharon, you started this conversation by saying Justin Trudeau had a bad week last week. And with regards to the pipeline, I can understand that. I don't know, and I don't understand how standing firm, taking on Trump, how showing up late for meetings and pushing back against Donald Trump can be seen as a bad thing in these negotiations.
Well, from what I saw on the right, a lot of people, Andrew Scheer and those buddies, were saying this is an example of how Trudeau can't get things done. This needs to be done. Trudeau can't get anything done. You know, he doesn't have the best interests of Canadians in mind.
Okay, I'm going to go on a rant.
That was the rhetoric that was coming out of the right. Was like, he can't get things. You saw Jason Kenney even had a few things about it, saying,
bullshit. Okay, you cannot, as a political leader in this country, involve yourself in the negotiations of your prime minister with another country, a very adversarial negotiation, and still claim to be on the side of Canadians. If you are constantly undermining your leader and your government in their attempts to get what they believe is the best deal for Canadians, and frankly, none of us know exactly what the details are or anything's been hashed out, the majority of these details seem to be very private and very kept under wraps. A negotiation, I will remind you, that the Liberal government have involved former Conservative prime ministers to advise on. You need to create a united front. And for someone, whether it be Jagmeet Singh, whether it be Andrew Scheer, whether it be Rachel Notley,
whoever,
to undermine the government as they engage in what are very intense and what would be very impactful negotiations to all Canadians for a very long time should a deal be signed, is so irresponsible frustrating to me. Again, this is this self-serving politicization of issues. I understand if a deal comes out and you disagree with certain aspects of it. That is fine. And you can be honest about that. And you can say, hey, I'm going to run against this in the next election. But to actively undermine and say things that undermine a negotiation as it's going on, to me, is so... such the opposite of what we need as a country right now. A particularly one of 38 million facing down a country of 350 million. Yeah. Sorry, end of rant.
Well, no, and I was going to say, I agree with you all. And I also think, you know, when you see comments like that from the opposition, it makes me think, is this really opposition, you know, a legitimate opposition, or is it opposition for opposition's sake? Because, we're in opposition, so we have to automatically oppose.
Oh, for sure.
You know?
And find a way to differentiate ourselves from Justin Trudeau. That's basically what it is. Some of the messaging is like, Justin Trudeau failed on NAFTA. It's time for the grown-ups to be in charge again. Standing up for Canadians starts with making sure Canada is strong. It also is pretty contradictory, because that's literally what Justin Trudeau is doing, as Elliot pointed out, is standing up for Canadians.
I think oppositions in general should rethink their roles. You know, part of being in opposition is being responsible in opposition, but supporting the government when, you know, that's what it calls for. Not to, you know, strike them down just because... we can, you know, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. I think there is a role for opposition support, and I'm talking in general, in any system. And, you know, opposition is to hold the government to account, but also, I think, as Ellie said, to support it when it should be supported.
For sure. And I think really another part of this is that this issue is also, surprise, surprise, more nuanced even than what we're talking about, because the reason why Trump is so hysterical about this and wanting to get NAFTA done is because Congress is expecting him to get NAFTA done. If Trump fails on getting this NAFTA deal together, that doesn't bode well for them, especially coming up here in November in the midterms. The GOP and Congress is really, really, really pushing Trump on their side to get the deal done, to come to the table and work with Canada and Mexico, because even though, of course, Canada is the smaller of, you know, the two between the U.S., we're all dependent on NAFTA, both sides of the border. And so in order for the U.S. to flourish, NAFTA and a trade agreement between Mexico and the U.S. is something that is needed. And so Trump is actually really at the mercy of this agreement in many ways. And you can see from a lot of things that he's been tweeting and saying, you know, Canada's so bad, yada, 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 that usually it means that he's kind of been pushed to a corner. And so a lot of the things that are coming out from his government is that they want things to get done, and that is why you see some of those reactions.
I mean, I think it's important to have an able and functioning opposition. And I do think, you know, you can't mute yourself in these situations as well, too. I would certainly be frustrated if I was Andrew Scheer, because it's very difficult to say anything without coming across as un-Canadian, getting the criticism I just gave in this situation. You do have a role to play off each other, so I don't want to say that he should be mum. But I think it's gone a little bit too far. And I think it's frustrating.
Absolutely.
Excuse me. Yeah.
So, I mean...
I'm dying here, everyone. Too many rants. Yeah. I can only do one rant.
The rants. So, I don't see a world where NAFTA or some kind of trilateral agreement isn't done. That's just impossible. Even though Trump keeps threatening.
He keeps saying that, but it's not going to happen.
Well, the notion there is that going, every time...
Enrique Peña Nieto, the outgoing Mexican president, he had his own State of the Union to the Mexican parliament, and again said Canada needs to be part of it.
Yes. Yeah. There's going to be an agreement. It's going to happen.
I don't know.
It's going to happen.
It's going to happen. It has to happen.
I'm not convinced. I think that you're almost at this point, like, I mean, I think something will come through and there will be some sort of document. What's going to be interesting, how different is it to the current agreement? Those are going to be the questions. That's what people are going to be commenting on. And that's where people are going to be asking, where were the wins for Canada? Where were the wins for the United States? And then, I'm looking forward to opposition criticism of whatever deal comes out of that. And, you know, a deal that, I'll remind you, also has to be ratified by Parliament and will go to debate, I assume.
Yes.
But also has to be ratified by Congress, because the President can't unilaterally join a trade deal. It has to go before Congress and be made a decision about, too. And we're, almost 60 days out from a congressional election for the, you know, House and one third of the Senate in the United States, which will impact that as well too. So there's tons of balls up in the air.
All the balls. Almost too many balls to talk about.
The High Level Showdown is brought to you by LitFest. Edmonton is home to Canada's first and only non-fiction festival. It runs October 11th to 21st, and it features dozens of events with writers from across the country and beyond sharing all kinds of stories and big ideas about culture, food, science, politics, and more. Among the writers are award-winning poet Billy Ray Belcour, musician and documentarian Dave Bendini, and so much more. That's just a sample. There are more listed at litfestalberta.org. Festival passes are just $129, and four packs and single tickets will also be available. Because they're sponsor of the High Level Showdown, you can get $5 off your order of tickets to LitFest Alberta. Just use the promo code APNROCKS. That's APNROCKS for $5 off your tickets to LitFest. Get your tickets at litfestalberta.org.
All right, so we've mentioned his name now a number of times on the show, but it is now the official time to talk about this person. So as you know, it's that time of the show, ladies and gentlemen. It is
Trump Watch.
Yes. So, Michael, why don't you kick this one off? Because you are emphatic that we talk about this article that came out of the New York
Times. Yeah, well, remember when Sharon used to say, hey, breaking news, it's breaking news, hot off the presses. So this is,
hot off the press.
a breaking news type of Trump Watch. We're recording September 5th. And just a few hours ago, an op-ed appeared in the New York Times, written by an anonymous White House staffer, a
senior official in the Trump administration.
That's right. So a person very close to the president. And this is a scathing indictment of...
Paul, is it indictment?
Yeah, no, that one I agree.
We'll get to that later.
I agree with that one. But anyway, this is a scathing critique of obviously Trump. And It's not so much what is said, because that we knew, that he has a temperament of a sixth grader, that he's amoral, that he's incapable of leadership. So it's not so much the content. What I think is important here is to note the source of this. And this isn't coming from a person who was fired from the White House or a Democrat or an opponent. This is a person, this is a Republican person, we're assuming, obviously. This is a person working in the inner circle. And to say these types of scathing and highly damaging comments is I don't think as we've ever seen in the current American presidential system. And it's also the title that is striking, because he says, or she or he or whoever this person is, we are part of the Trump resistance, and myself and assumedly other people in this administration, we're actually keeping everything afloat, because if we'd let him get away with everything, then we really would have gone down the rabbit hole. So there are adults in the room, this person says. Americans, don't fear. We're, as much as this is a circus, we are trying everything we can to keep things afloat in the face of this reckless and ignorant leadership. So for me, the strikingness of it is the fact that, we're talking about, I don't know if you would say a mutiny of sorts, but people are getting fed up. And we're not talking just about opponents or Democrats, but really a lot of the American populace and Republican supporters, even though it doesn't seem like it in Congress, are saying this is really, really spiraling out of control.
I mean, I think the most telling quote is that is why many Trump appointees have vowed to do what we can to preserve our democratic institutions while thwarting Mr. Trump's more misguided impulses until he is out of office.
I'm going to be honest, I rolled my eyes the entire time reading this opinion editorial.
Oh, really, Sharon? Tell us why.
it's just kind of bullshit. Sorry, Mom. I've cursed a lot in this episode. Because, okay, yeah. Fair point, you know. Wow, we know Trump is, like, unhinged and we're doing everything that we can. I think at one point he called all the people who are part of his quote-unquote he or she's, or they, it's part of their, just kidding. Trump would never hire someone who goes by the pronouns they.
Or she, for that matter.
Or she.
Except his daughter, maybe.
But, you know, I think at one point he called them unsung heroes in the White House. Because of the hard work they're doing, keeping an, in their words, unhinged and unstable and unfit for president person in power. I don't think we should be patting our backs for someone who's willing to write an opinion editorial. And apparently the people in their administration who are willing to work behind closed doors rather than coming out and saying, you know what, enough is enough. This needs to stop, and actually doing something to take the unfit and unhinged person out of office.
I mean, I'm totally with you. This is some fucking bullshit. This person literally says, I'm here to save the world. Don't worry, we're in the room taking care. You know how you actually make some change? You quit the White House, you publicize your name, and you tell everyone about the truth about what's really going on behind those closed doors. In this article, you know, there's a team of people, and by the way, meetings go off track, and he loses train of thought, and he goes into all these different... Yeah, we all know that. Yeah. Tell us what's actually going on, but you can't because you need to remain anonymous because you still want your job.
Yeah,
and you
benefit from the privilege of being there. I think at one point he's like, you know what, hasn't all been bad. We were so happy when we got the tax reforms. You mean the
those
tax reforms
despite
and tax
the president.
Despite the president, we got the tax reform. We're so happy of all these things that keep, you know, people like Trump in privilege and in power. It's BS.
Well, and I mean, that is, I think, the New York... I mean, I'm even mad at the New York Times for publishing this. This is, like, some real fucking bullshit. Because, honestly, if you're going to go and commend... Like, the idea is that this is a conservative person with conservative ideals, conservative credentials, coming out against Trump. There's lots of people who are doing that, who decided not to join the presidency, who are not helping to push a right-wing agenda that empowers the most rich and wealthy in the country and undermines the poorest and most disadvantaged and people of color. You're literally supporting the government of a white nationalist who has no trouble taking kids away from their parents at the border. But yes, we'll stay fucking anonymous, and yes, New York Times will post... We'll post this bullshit on there and make this person to some kind of hero when this is not how you make changes. All this is doing is upsetting things and provides no information, no context, no actual examples as to why. You want to make a difference? Quit the job and publish what actually is going on.
And it's also a really good point, Elliot, because it's also very easily...
It's also very easily
pushed aside.
I'm not against what
Trump.
You're saying. I still think it is an important...
It's also very easily discredited by Trump. You know,
course.
It's very easy for him to be like, this random anonymous person by the failing New York Times comes out. And the
is that
other
literally
thing,
the tweet? That'd be hilarious.
I think he said something like that. The thing that also really bothers me is how this person chose to end this editorial. And of course, evoked John McCain, the great, you know, mediator apparently, who brought together both sides, you know, rest in peace, John McCain. You were still kind of shitty.
You want to go 10 rounds on John McCain? I'll go 10 rounds with you on John McCain.
But the thing that was interesting is saying that, you know, this person said we shouldn't let Trump sink us down to his level. We need to reach across the aisle and be civil and hold hands and bring our country up together. What does that even mean? For the day-to-day person, the people being separated at the border, people being snatched up by ICE, the people in Flint who still don't have clean water, the people who are being shot up by, you know, police, whatever it may be, whatever injustices, people who are losing their jobs, whatever it may be, these people are supposed to reach across the aisle to whom? And raise up in civility. You know what real civility is? It isn't saying that, you know, I'm behind Trump's closed doors trying to get things done. Instead of saying don't sink to Trump's level, this person needs to be, like Elliot says, rising above Trump and doing what they can to get this person out of office. It was such a weird, like, call to action at the end.
We get this all the time, like General
Kelly. It was so bizarre.
Chief of Staff, American hero for reigning in Trump. Mattis, making sure that Donald Trump doesn't assassinate foreign leaders. Like, come on. Like, I don't agree with that notion. You don't just get to play ball and hang out and, you know, basically fill your cupboards with notes for your book after your job is done. If you really cared about the country, if you really cared about the institutions that you so-called say are there to protect, you have a duty and obligation to expose the truth and the lies and the bullshit and the hypocrisy. And frankly, the poor mental state of this person who's running the most powerful country in the world. Sorry, Michael, we kind of took over.
No. I mean, that's fine. I think those are all what you all, both of what you said is valid. I still do think it is noteworthy, regardless of motivations or not, that there is a person, again, I don't recall seeing something like this. Certainly, I'm a young person, so I don't have, you know, a lot of memory of past American presidents. But in my time of following American politics,
for sure,
regardless of, as you say, you know, they're being heroes or fake, there has not been something like this from the inside that not only calls out the incompetencies of this man as president, but that, you know, they're trying literally to stop him from doing damaging things. I mean, and you could argue, well, they're not, because they're enabling him, and that's fair. But some of the little statements, you know, we had to take papers off his desk, or we've had to, you know, calm him down. I mean, stuff like that, to me, I mean, it's just striking. Obviously, it's striking to many people, but it just further speaks to the historical nature of this presidency. He will obviously go down in history. And he said, you know, he said many times, Donald Trump, you know, no president, no presidency in history has ever done the things that that my presidency has done. You're right, Donald.
But Michael,
no presidency, no presidency in history has done what you have done.
I mean, this is but this kind of journalism, this kind of bullshit, is the stuff that empowers Trump.
Yeah.
It's why on Trump Watch we do the little things and we don't, because, and we want to look at small issues. And I think that this, you know, it fits Trump Watch, and I think we're right to discuss it. But it's this kind of, you know, part of the reason why you've never seen an article written like this about another previous a previous president is because no journalist would have the editorial balls, because this is editorial. I think this is terrible as a terrible editorial decision to publish this. No one would ever have done that, because it's just bad journalism. That's why you're not getting, you know, I'm sure people have for multitudes of years tried to publish anonymous opinion articles, and to the credit of news agencies in the United States and Canada and everywhere, they've said no, because it's just bad journalism. It's bad form. There's nothing here that I feel is credible. And all it does is to empower Donald Trump and empower people who support him to further claims of a deep state, to further claims that the media is against him.
Yeah.
And I mean, part of the power of Donald Trump and how he's risen to where he is a weakened media environment in the United States that he has preyed on. And it's this kind of bullshit that they produce that he has preyed on and eaten alive and allowed him to get to that point. That's my struggle with this kind of journalism and this kind of thing. Like, there's nothing in there that we don't know. I agree with you, and I know we're parallel on the way in which we feel about Donald Trump and the way that we act. But this is the stuff that empowers him and empowers his base. And allows him to thrive and grow. This is not how you undermine a tyrant. This isn't how you undermine an awful human being who leeches off our worst fears and the weaknesses of people.
An awful human being, all right?
Yeah.
That's my issue.
So that's the kindest thing you could say about him. He's an awful human being.
This is trash.
Trump is trash.
Trump is trash.
And a white nationalist. I'm getting used to saying white nationalist president.
You Donald like
Trump.
It?
I like it. I mean, not that he is a white nationalist. Shall we go to 780s?
780.
So I want to do a shout out to not a local business, but a program on the CBC that is in large part as to why I think I am here. And that is because I had the good fortune for a majority of my time growing up listening to As It Happens in its various forms throughout my life. And I discovered this week that As It Happens is in the process of celebrating its 50th anniversary on the radio. I think like 7 or 8 hosts at least. It does the kind of journalism that is fun, quirky, but also can be very hard-hitting and very direct. And I think it showcases the best talent of the CBC from across the country, and oftentimes has clued me into the subtleties of life in other parts of the country that I've never visited that I don't know as well, and has helped to formulate my idea of what it means to be Canadian and what all of Canada is. And so congratulations to As It Happens, and they've got an interesting feature where you can actually go through a timeline and look at different episodes from different times and across the show's history with different hosts, and they've been kind of sampling a bit of that throughout this week. And so my 780 goes out to As It Happens, the show.
My 780 this week goes out to a great friend of mine sitting across from me.
Sharon, please.
Elliot Tanti.
Stop it.
Our lovely co-host. If some of you got the...
I don't like the self-promotion happening.
He's not self-promoting. Don't edit this out. So some of you in Edmonton probably have gotten the Yards magazine, a great local magazine, in your mailboxes if you live in the downtown core. If you don't live in the core, you'll have to go out and search for it or wait for the online issue to be published, because there's a great feature by Daniel Parody in the newest issue of the Yards, and it features people working in their community to make life better, responding to need. And Elliot is one of the people featured for his amazing work in our community, helping some of the most vulnerable people in our city at his day job at Boyle Street Community Services. So he's not even looking at me right now and hiding his head, but I think it's worth celebrating because Elliot and everyone at the organization does really great work, and you deserve to be honored, friend. So I'm going to gas you up.
Very nice.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Sharon.
Right, mine is on a more somber note. I'm sure many of our listeners saw the news at the National Museum of Brazil in Rio de Janeiro, a 200-year-old building with up to 2 million historical and cultural artifacts, was destroyed by a raging inferno, and up to 90% of the artifacts were destroyed. And my 780 then is a call to all of you, wherever you may live, to call on your governments to invest and protect the arts. Because this building in Rio de Janeiro was not equipped, was not modernized for many, many years, what we have now discovered in the aftermath of this tragedy. Of course, Brazil hosted the World Cup and the Olympics and had no trouble spending billions of dollars on stadiums and Olympic villages, but they couldn't even install...
Sports are important too, Michael.
They couldn't even install sprinklers.
Yeah, the president, she was impeached for stuffing her pockets.
Right. So all this massive spending, but that they couldn't even modernize or install sprinklers in a 200-year-old museum that housed priceless cultural artifacts. And, you know, it's lost now. That is just a damn shame. It is. So demand that your governments or whoever runs your cultural institutions, that they are protecting these national treasures, and, you know, that it is important to have funding not only for these treasures, but where they are housed, because they need to be protected. We often talk, of course, of the human tragedy of the Syrian civil war, but, you know, what's less talked about is the cultural tragedy. You know how many sites and arts have been destroyed and looted in Syria, the ancient material that has been lost? And, you know, this is similar. This is a lot of historical artifacts that were destroyed because the government didn't care to safeguard the building that it was in. So just a call to action to, you know, stand up for the preservation of arts and our culture. Because that's who we are.
Really great point, Michael. Before we wrap up this show, a couple of things. First of all, we had a poll last week.
Oh, yes.
The great debate of the word S-C-H-I-S-M. Michael said it one way.
No, I said I heard it both ways.
We said it the other way.
I said I heard it both
ways. This actually broke the record of people who responded to our poll. More people voted in this poll than any other poll.
Votes.
It actually doubled our our poll numbers. So, Michael, I'm sorry to say.
No, but I told you. I heard it both ways.
I'm sorry to say, Michael, that
but obviously,
80,
we're not gonna,
an overwhelming 80% of people said it's schism.
Yeah.
with a hard.
But who are those 20%?
Who the hell are
they? Who are 20%? It's probably you on multiple accounts.
I have multiple accounts. Well, like I said before we started recording, it's maybe one of those words like, what did I say, Celtic?
Oh, then Michael continued. He said, I dislike rap very much.
Yeah, but there's lots of things that have been going on our Twitter. And I said I'm filing in under things that Michael and I are never discussing.
Our friends at the Alberta Podcast Network made a pun on Snoop Dogg.
The last thing is I would like to wish a very, very happy birthday. Tomorrow is the 30th birthday of our beer sponsor, John. And so John has his birthday tomorrow. So shout out to him. We can't wait to try our next homebrew, which I think he was bottling today. So we might be having it in a couple weeks, guys.
Happy birthday, John.
Happy 30th birthday. Thanks so much for listening, guys. If you'd like to find us online and answer our poll, which we'll release.
What is the pipeline? Will the pipeline be built?
Oh, wow. I mean, okay, sure.
We'll decide.
You can find us at High Level Show on Twitter. You can find me at Sharon MVU.
I'm at Tanti YEG.
I'm at Maestro Michael 2.
We'll be back in a week, guys.
Adios.
Good night.